Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, listeners. I'm Mark Klobis, and welcome to the fifth podcast of Arguing History, where renowned historians meet to debate some of the key points in our past. A century ago, American women were engaged in two great struggles simultaneously, participating in the war to end all wars and fighting to win the suffrage nationwide. But were these two campaigns separate, or did the efforts of women in one of them shape the result in the other? To discuss the interrelationship of women's suffrage and the First World War, we have with us today two renowned scholars of American history. The first is Lynn Dumental, who is Robert Glass Cleland Professor of American History Emerita at Occidental College and the author of The Second Line of Defense, American Women in World War I, The Modern Temper, American Culture and Society in the 1920s, and Through Women's Eyes, which she co-authored with Ellen Carroll Dubois. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
The second is Christopher Capozla, who is Associate Professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the author of Uncle Sam Wants You, World War I and the Making of the Modern American Citizen, and co-curator of The Volunteers, Americans Join World War I, a multi-platform public history initiative commemorating the centennial of America's First World War. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, I'd like to start off by asking you the question, what role did World War I play in helping women get the right to vote?
Well, I think it's a big question. For me, it's a question of the context in which a century-long struggle that different women's organizations had been fighting to achieve the right to vote, the context suddenly changes with the war. The idea that women should vote was not new, that women organizing for the right to vote was not new. Whether they would do this state by state or at a national level through a constitutional amendment, that was an ongoing debate. The extent to which they were willing to fight for women of color and their right to vote, all of these questions are already on the table when war hits in Europe. But what the war does is it changes the context in which suffragist women can make their claims. And what's interesting is sometimes it makes it harder for them to make their claims. War leaders respond by saying, not now. Let's not talk about this now. And sometimes it makes it easier because they're able to fold their claims into the war effort. I guess probably a lot of people on your podcast respond to a question by saying, well, it's complicated. That's a historian's favorite answer to every question. And I think in this case, it's complicated.
I would agree with that. And I think that one of the ways I like to think about it, Chris is suggesting that we think about how long the suffrage movement was in place, but I'm really interested in how intense it was right before the war between, say, 1900 and 1914. Already 11 states had enfranchised women, and there's a kind of sense of excitement about a new woman, not just about the vote, but about more women in the workplace, women engaged in social reform, the birth control movement. So there's a lot going on in that period right before the war. And there's a kind of way in which this movement, and particularly the suffrage movement, is in place, and then it hits and intersects with the war. And as we our maybe our word for the day will be, it does complicate things. And one way to add to what Chris has already said is, you know, in the midst of a war, citizenship tends often to be defined by male military service. And so women who are trying to increase their political rights in the midst of war also have that sort of trick. They have to finesse the notion that the ultimate form of citizenship is male sacrifice on the battlefield.
And that gets to an interesting question, because both of you have referenced the pre-war state of the women's suffrage movement, and you've described that there's a degree of momentum taking that's been developing, and yet wasn't that momentum fairly even more compressed than just 1900 to 1914, and wasn't there also a counter movement that was doing a lot to try to push back against that? I mean, it wasn't necessarily that women were on this clear sailing path that they were definitely on the cusp of achieving national suffrage prior to 1914 or 1917, was it?
Chris, do you want to start with that, or do you want me to?
Why don't you start? Because I think you've written directly about this.
Okay. I think that's a good point, that certainly there are anti-suffragists. And during the preparedness period, right before when the European war begins, but before the United States enters, a lot of more conservative women are also people who were opposed to suffrage, and they are suspicious of the suffrage movement, in part because the suffrage movement aligned very closely with the peace movement until 1917 and late 16. So there's again, the war is complicating the story, but there's a lot of pushback against organized womanhood, as it was often called, and some of it was on the part of women, other women, who had a different take on the war and on suffrage itself.
Yeah.
Am I speaking to your question?
You did, Chris.
Yeah. No, I think. I think that gets at what changes during the run up to the war. But I think just I want to, let's take up Mark's question for a second. I think there, you could make an argument that, so there's two ways to make the argument. One is, there is this burst of organized suffrage activity between 1900 and 1914, these 11 state victories that Lynn talks about. And you could extend that argument and say, look, even if there hadn't been a war, the momentum was building, women's roles and lives were changing, and this is going to happen. And I think that that's the argument that Lynn is making. I mostly agree with that, but let me make the counter argument, which is to say that there's one of the counter arguments would say, well, state by state victories by women were mostly achieved already in the states in which women were likely to achieve suffrage, and so in states with a lot of organized women, states without a lot of opposition, states where voting rights were less politicized. So outside the South, for example, where extending the right to vote to women raised questions about denying it to African-American men. So the counter argument would say there was a momentum, but it was that momentum was about to run into a brick wall, particularly in the South. And it was only the war and the kind of the push for thinking about everything at the federal level, about prohibition at the federal level, immigration, taxation, and ultimately women's suffrage, that allowed it to come through as a national amendment. So, Lynn, I don't know, what do you think about that?
Well, I think you make a good point. And I also, I think it's particularly important to raise the issue about that's a lot of the resistance to suffrage had to do with race. That's real important. And in fact, the white women's suffrage movement excluded Black women suffragists from their organizations for the most part. So just as a little side note, I wanted to thank you for bringing that up. I had it on my notes, but hadn't said it yet. But I think here's what I think. I think that part of the momentum that's so interesting is that women particularly are shaped by young women coming into the suffrage movement with new tactics. They're influenced by the British, who are more militant. They're starting to use modern publicity techniques. They are doing the parades. The first one was in 1911 in New York, which was really quite shocking at the time because it defied notions of respectability. In 1913, they had their first women's march at the presidential inauguration, which is fitting to note since we have a march tomorrow scheduled. So I think that something is in place that is different than just the same old in terms of the movement and the way it's and the momentum that I was talking about. However, I would agree with you that I think if it weren't for the war, it would have taken much longer to pass suffrage. And Carrie Chapman Catt says the war made suffrage possible. And I don't think she would mean that to deny all the work that went before. But I think it's true that the war is the speed up process that's really important.
Mm-hmm. The two of you reference a dimension of it that perhaps in thinking about it as a in the positive sense of women fighting to achieve the vote, that probably needs to be brought in as well, which is the campaigners against it. And you've already mentioned the female anti-suffragists. I was thinking about another group that often is brought into the mix that is seen as having been very prominent in their opposition to the women's vote, and that was the saloon interest. And mm-hmm. I bring it in as in the way of thinking about how you have this public discourse, battlefield, if you will, in which you have these size array, they have certain strengths, certain weapons, if you will, to bear, and how that, in a sense, it helps to define this pre-war world that you were referring to, Chris. But it seems that one of the things that the war does, and correct me if I'm wrong here, does it perhaps shake that up to such an extent as to create the opening, as to create an opening for women to exploit that would not have been there had there counterfactually been no entry into the war to begin with?
I'm not sure I'm following the question very clearly. I thought where you were headed was that because prohibition is starting to emerge as a war measure, it ceases to be an important anti-factor because the saloon interests are losing their power in part because prohibition is starting to be successful, in part because they're associated with German Americans. But so that's where I thought you were going. So I'm not sure
that is the direction I'm going. I'm wondering about, does that, in terms of talking about the interrelationship between the First World War and women's suffrage, is that perhaps a factor that that we haven't really raised up until this point, this idea that it's not just about what happens with the women, it's what happens who are campaigning to get the vote. It's also what happens to those groups, what's happening to those groups that have been organizing and fighting against that vote, not just the female anti-suffragists, but the male groups who've been tied to interests who now suddenly find their worlds disrupted by America's entry into the war.
I think that's true. I think that's more true as an explanation for prohibition and why the prohibition amendment moves through so quickly in the end of the war and then sort of gets implemented in 1920, in part because there was no organized opposition to prohibition except the brewing industry, which, as Lynn points out, was decimated because of its connections to Germany and German Americans. It is certainly the case that brewing industry and others did oppose women's suffrage, in part because they believed, rightly, that increasing voice for women would probably increase the voice for restrictions on alcohol. it is, and there were some suffrage women, and I think Carrie Chapman Catt was among them, who were quite willing to sort of dredge up sort of German anti-suffragism as evidence for the rightness of their cause. Right, that suddenly the war's on, and if your enemy is a, you know, is your enemy is a friend of Germany, then clearly that puts you in the right. But I think it was less central to the women's suffrage debate than it was to the prohibition debate.
I would agree. Though you raise an interesting question, I'll have to think more about it, Mark.
I also wanted to mention another dynamic, because one of the things that prompted the question is this consideration of how, you know, and both you've already brought this in, that you can't consider these groups in isolation. And another element, and there's already been some reference to this, is preparedness. To what degree did women's involvement in preparedness campaigns help them in terms of making the case for their civic engagement, versus to what degree did preparedness campaigns represent a diversion of energies in terms of women's participation in the public sphere?
Well, one of the things I found really interesting about preparedness women is they're not necessarily anti-suffrage, but they and they're not necessarily, you know, against the vote per se, but they're not happy with the suffrage movement's stance on peace. But one of the things that happens that I find so interesting is they become so politically active, and they have camps and they have parades and marches. And so I think that your point about they're another way in which women are taking to political activism, even though they're not necessarily doing it in the name of earning the right to vote, they are sort of demonstrating women's citizenship. And that's part of the sort of vocabulary of the war era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, Lynn, you raise a good point that I think a lot of people, you know, haven't thought about this since their high school history textbooks sort of overlook, which is sort of thinking that women weren't involved in politics until they got the right to vote.
Right.
And that's really not true. That women were deeply involved in civic life, in public life, in public debates about a wide range of topics. They were denied the right to vote in most areas, varied by state and locality. And they were, even when they were engaged in public debates and civic debates, they were often excluded from serious decision-making power, mm-hmm. over, you know, decisions, budget, staffing, anything like that. But it would be wrong to think that women were not political before they got the right to vote. But for women who in the years from 1914 to 1917, who are, you know, watching Americans or watching Europe at war and trying to sort of figure out what, what America's role will be, how America should respond, the preparedness movement is a real opportunity for them. They say, we want to make sure that America is ready for war, that it has the military it needs, that it has the citizens it needs, and that it has the women that it needs. And a lot of women preparedness organizations focus on sort of mobilizing women for military defense and patriotism and civic project more generally. I think these women would often fall in the category of women who were willing to put the suffrage question to the side for the duration, who felt, country first, war first, and that women who prove themselves to be good citizens will be rewarded with the vote after the war. And you definitely see that that rhetoric coming through. And this gets at what you were saying before, that's going to make them very angry when they see sort of pacifist women and suffragist women who are really sort of trying to democratize the country and bring world peace at the same time. And it's almost, they're almost at polar opposites.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does it also create this sense of frustration among the women who are very prominently campaigning for suffrage, the sense that this is yet another distraction on the road to the vote because both of you have referenced this momentum that's been been developing over the previous decade, and then now all of a sudden you have this group of women who are arguing we need to set this aside. It's like, you know, we're finally up to speed, and now here we are having to slow down a bit and let something a more immediate priority pass us by. Did that create a certain amount of tension as well?
I'm not sure that it did. I think that what worried women on the other side of preparedness about preparedness was preparedness. The militarization was of the nation. The call, for example, for universal military training in high schools, that kind of thing, was really alarming to these women. And so although many of the suffrage leaders had suffrage as, you know, their sort of one issue, I think that in the period we're talking about, there was a tremendous amount of anxiety about preparedness and about the move towards war. And so that it wasn't a kind of uni-cause kind of approach. But I may be wrong about that, but I think that's the case.
Yeah, I wonder if we should just talk about Jane Addams for a minute, because I think that her experience really sheds a lot of light on the complications that we were talking about before, right? And so this is, really the one of the most popular figures in the progressive era, widely known for her work at Hull House in Chicago with children and immigrants and others, and really in some ways a national hero to many Americans. And for Jane Addams, the coming of war in Europe in 1914 is a catastrophe, right? It's a political catastrophe, a humanitarian crisis. She is deeply involved in trying to make sure that that civilians and others in Belgium and France have food and shelter and all kinds of things that are as they're displaced in a refugee crisis. But Jane Addams, who was a lifelong suffragist, she sees this war through a gendered lens. And she is quite convinced that if women had a real voice in politics, if they had a real voice in their own country's politics and as well as globally, that the war wouldn't have happened. And that if they were given a voice right away, that they could actually have a role in stopping it. There was still a belief in 1914-15 and even onward that the war could be ended through compromise and truce rather than unconditional surrender by one side. Addams doesn't really see this as a choice of, should I go for suffrage or should I go for peace? It's all one thing bound up for her.
I think that's an excellent point, and I think that's the case for many women of the era.
Would that be true for the women in preparedness as well? The sense that that they wanted to have a voice in the vote, maybe to offset this claim that they felt that their, in a sense, demand for preparedness also needed to be registered.
I don't see them talking about suffrage that much. I think they are focused on preparing the nation, and they argue that women have a role in this. But I don't think that they are focused on or talk very much about suffrage per se. But this is not my area of strength, so I could be wrong about that. There may be a specialized study that says something else.
I think you're right. I think for the most part, I also don't see them talking about suffrage. And when they do, it's something that they feel can be talked about later, or is really part of a broader package of women's nationalism to a large extent.
Could I shift the conversation a little bit? And I have a segue about peace, but
please do.
Good. Because I think particularly for a listening audience that doesn't know very much about the details of the suffrage activism during the war, it might be well to point out that what happens is when the war, when the United States is close to joining the war, the main suffrage organization, NASA, as we call it, endorses the war and pulls away from the suffrage movement. The more younger, smaller militant group led by Alice Paul, that's usually associated with the Women's Party, refuses to take a stance on the war. And the two organizations, which were split over other issues, such as do we do a national amendment? Do we use political leverage? Do we, you know, work against the Democrats because they're the party in power? This group, they were already in conflict, and now they really become in conflict because one organization says, let's support the war and show by our good citizenship and our loyalty and our efforts to raise funds and promote food conservation that we are good citizens who deserve the vote. Whereas the women associated with what will become the Women's Party picket the White House and create a kind of disruptive power. And so that's really the other big question about suffrage in the war. Was it the good women who were doing the service side of the war that helps to promote suffrage? Or is it the picketers who helped to promote the final passage of the suffrage movement?
If I may throw in one additional question, to what degree was that embrace a very conscious need to push back against the women like Jane Addams, who had taken such a prominent stance and against the war? And to what degree did the organizations like NASA feel that they had to come out in favor of the war in order to offset any possible undoing of the gains that they had made in suffrage up to that point?
I think it's absolutely central. And NASA at both a national level and many sort of NASA chapters at local levels essentially sort of drum out pacifist members of their organization or silence them. In part because they are afraid that that too much peace talk from these groups will discredit the organization. And this gets very intense by the summer of 1917 with the passage of the Espionage Act, and which is amended with the Sedition Act of 1918 a year later, which really makes sort of statements or publications questioning the war into federal crimes. And so NASA really does take great steps to silence the pacifist members, and they're doing it in part because they're facing pressure in the press from federal agents and from pro-war women within the ranks of their own organization.
There's a lot of tension within women's groups as you get into the beginning of 1917 over what's appropriate. And I just lost my train of thought. I had something I was going to say about the pressure on women, but I've lost it. I'll come back to it if I think of it. Sorry.
But I think to go back to your earlier point, Lynn, you raised the million-dollar question, right? Which is, was the suffrage victory really the work of the sort of moderate women in NASA who cast their lot with the war and are patient on suffrage, or the radical women in the National Women's Party who are saying, no, if this is a war for democracy, that means democracy here at home. And I think, it's obviously a relationship between the two of them. But I'd be curious to know, you framed the question. I'd be curious to know how you would answer it.
I always loved to, when I was in the teaching mode, I always loved to do that, to ask students what they thought, because I think often the answer comes from one's own political persuasion. Do you want to be the person on the picket line, or do you want to be the moderate? But we know what works best, protest or moderation. But I happen to think that it's a combination of the two things, that the two types of approach, the proving our service and protesting, sort of work together in a sort of interesting way. So for example, the moderate women who are so active in supporting the war and using their publicity machine to show that women are supporting the war. There are parades, there are articles, there's an enormous amount of interest and publicity about women's role in, and particularly as volunteers, but also women munitions workers doing their service. So on the one hand, you have all of this enormous attention to the suffrage women who are supporting the war. But on the other hand, when Alice Paul's group picket and then are arrested and they're force-fed and it becomes a huge publicity issue of another sort, the Wilson White House is very nervous about these women and what they're up to, particularly because they're worried about the congressional elections of 1918. There's a lot of discussion about whether the bad press about how these women are being treated will hurt the Democratic Party. And I think a lot of Wilson's decision to come out in support of the amendment, which is what both organizations wanted, has a lot to do with his trying to stem the bad publicity of Alice Paul's group. But on the other hand, when he goes to Congress and makes his impassioned speech, what he talks about is the extraordinary service that the moderate suffragists had given the nation in time of war. So he's able to use that as his rationale, which is a pretty important piece of his explanation of why women needed the vote.
Yeah, I think that to me, that back and forth dynamic is really important. And in some ways, the radicalism of the National Women's Party, which certainly angered many people in NASA, but it also gave them cover.
Yes,
to seem less threatening than they were. And we see this in social movements of all kinds in American history, right? That the picketers make the moderates who were otherwise unacceptable into the acceptable option. But the other part I think that we forget is that the National Woman's Party wasn't just rhetoric, radical rhetoric and images and protests and marches. They were also building institutions on the ground so that they could actually follow up and do the kind of the tours, the public speaking, and call out, get out the vote, particularly in areas where women could vote. There are strands of radicalism hiding under NASA's umbrella, and there are strands of moderate, mundane organization hiding under the NWP.
If I could just underline that really good point, I think that one of the things that the Women's Party does in the beginning of 1913 and 14 is say, okay, there are women have the vote in X states. So we're going to organize them as voters to vote to show women's ability to have some political leverage, particularly on the Democratic Party. And so there's some very savvy political leveraging going on here that, as you say, is another piece of the story. And it's something that NASA didn't approve of. They wanted to be nonpartisan. Women's Party and Alice Paul's group had a much different approach, and it was really brilliant, I think.
Both of you have been talking about this in terms of the various organizations that have been campaigning for suffrage. I was wondering if we could broaden it a bit to talk more about how women, the participation of women in the war effort in all the myriad ways might have shaped perceptions. And I'm thinking here in particular about your most recent book, Lynn, because in reading it, it's very fascinating to see all the ways in which women were involved in the munitions workers that you've already referenced, taking up men's jobs in places like shipyards, but also the ways in which they encouraged the men in their lives to get involved, the way they participated in campaigns on the home front. Is there any sense that these helped to shift opinions in any way in terms of the thinking among men and maybe even anti-suffrage women, that women had demonstrated that not just through their activism politically, but through their participation civically, that their time to vote receive the vote had come?
Well, yes, I think that there's so much publicity given to women's activism, and as you say, people who are working. Some of it is people who are working as volunteers. We haven't talked about all the publicity given to women who go overseas in various capacities. So I definitely think that the American public was offered a lot of evidence for women's good citizenship. But they were also, by virtue of women running around wearing uniforms and marching and challenging conventional notions of proper behavior, there could have also led to a certain amount of backlash against women crossing boundaries, particularly in terms of the kinds of work they were doing or wearing uniforms or even serving in the military.
Yeah, there are sort of ways in which scholars who've looked at sort of gender and war have looked at not just how it upsets traditional gender notions, but often how it also confirms them. Through the centrality of masculinity to soldiering, and then the way that highlights roles for women that are distinct, right? That if the ideal citizen in wartime is a male soldier, then that means that that women are going to have to in some ways either mimic those roles, right, by saying we're doing things that soldiers are doing. We're even sort of wearing uniforms, or doing things that are quite distinct. And roles, very sort of feminized, sort of gendered visions of what a woman should do in war also appear. The caring mother, the waiting wife, all these kinds of images. Lots of posters a lot more posters of angels than of Joan of Arc, but there are both images there, but I think it's very difficult, and women are navigating this not in new ways, right? They've been receiving mixed messages about women, what women can be and do for their whole lives, but the context in which they're doing that is changing.
I think that's an excellent point. I'm also thinking about all the attention to women knitters, which is part of that piece of doing very sort of traditional domestic things to support the war effort.
Yeah, and the war, and this, Lynn, you write about in your book, the war, certainly does open up some new jobs for women that had not been there before. But the economic sort of impact on the U.S. is much shorter and much less in World War One than World War Two. So to the extent that women enter the workforce in greater numbers in World War One, a lot of them are women who are young women or unmarried women who might have otherwise been in the paid workforce, or they end up in very sex segregated kinds of positions. So you don't see the Rosie the Riveter story that you get in World War Two. And even that story may not be all that true either.
Yes to both. it's true that one of the things that's sort of startling is that people were so convinced during the war that such change would emerge because of all the visibility of women in the workforce and in volunteer work. And in fact, there's not much to show for it after the war in that regard. Women's economic opportunities don't open up dramatically, particularly sex segregated labor returns to its former former pattern. African-American women who had been given the opportunity to work in factories for the first time because of the labor shortages find themselves back in domestic and agricultural labor after the war. So a lot of the what we might view as the promise of the war for offering women more opportunities really was limited by war's end. And in fact, what you really end up with is the major thing accomplished through the war is suffrage. That's the one sort of clear thing that we can say is this: the war helped suffrage. Suffrage is something that was concrete that emerged in the post-war years.
And that gets to something that I was hoping maybe you could elaborate upon, Chris, because with all the concerns about Americanism and this intertwining of engagement and participation in the war with this definition of American citizenship, it seems that that idea of what it meant to be American citizen was in a bit of a flux, and that it was in a way that women were able to take advantage of, or am I misinterpreting that?
No, I mean, I think it was in flux, which is in some ways what it means to be a citizen is always in flux. What it is it's under the microscope or under the spotlight in ways that it maybe hadn't been before. What the federal government can ask of you is a much more important question when they're mobilizing for war. And so in that sense, the war makes citizenship a necessary debate to have because it has to be, the question has to be answered for the period of the war effort. But it also means that those ongoing debates about, you know, what is it, you know, does your obligation as a citizen vary if you're a man or a woman, is, you know, that's going to become a wartime debate in because of the needs of war mobilization. So yes, there are opportunities for women, but they leverage them when they can, both organized women in organizations as well as, you know, just ordinary women who are figuring out, you know, how to write a letter to the federal government and get something, or how to find a job in a war related industry. So yes, they're taking advantage of those opportunities. But I think the real story is what the country demands of people in wartime, that the opportunities are less significant in some ways than the obligations, which are enforced, and which because of restrictive laws like the Espionage and Sedition Acts are very hard to question or to challenge.
And that those obligations seem to be much more pressing than any that women have faced up until this time. I mean, I think back to previous wars and women were very much involved in them, but there was never a sense that the government was needing them to step up and assume roles that were seen as outside the canon. You have examples where women did do those things, were individual cases, but in World War I, the scale of it meant that women had to do it much more collectively in much greater numbers than had ever been the experience in American history.
Yes, I think, in that sense, because it is part of this unprecedented mobilization for war, and particularly an unprecedented kind of federal mobilization for war, that is necessarily going to make demands on women that had not been made before. There, of course, were women involved on the home front and even at the front in the Civil War and other conflicts. But because the war appeared to require the mobilization of all of American society, its labor, its finances, and its minds, its politics, its political views, then that meant mobilizing women as well. So women are you know, are recruited for labor, but also tapped for it. That knitting is not just symbolic. That's actually how a substantial proportion of American uniforms and bandages were produced. Their purchase of war bonds mattered because women had money, you know, and their ideas and their viewpoints had to be mobilized as well, or suppressed when they were dissenting.
I would agree with all that. I think there's a sort of interesting problem about mobilizing women as volunteers to leave aside the women who are working. And that is that American women were so organized in their clubs and their organizations. And these were women all sort of now ready to use their organizations to serve the nation in various ways. And the federal government really was sort of, I think, not really prepared for women to come in and decide what they wanted to do with mobilization. There's a lot of tension between federal officials and on state level officials as well, and women's groups that have their own ideas of how they're going to mobilize women. And a good example of this is the food conservation drive, which is one that is allegedly volunteer, although there's a lot of coercion implicit in it, something that Chris has written about. But what's interesting is the women's organizations wanted to and had their own plans of how they would help promote the food conservation drive, but Herbert Hoover pretty much undercuts their decision-making process and sets it up. He uses women's organizations, and they do agree to follow the federal guidelines, but there's tension between federal authorities and women's groups on the ground.
So if to build upon what you were saying in terms of how there is definitely a benefit for women's suffrage activism in terms of their involvement in the war, when do they start seeing it? Because we've also talked about how a lot of women were wanting to set the issue aside, and yet you have, within a very short period of time, you have the end of the war in November of 1918, and you've very shortly thereafter the passage of the 19th Amendment. When when do we see that impact really at play in terms of the suffrage debate?
Well, I just want to mention something about the dates that I think is kind of interesting. Wilson finally commits to the amendment in January of 1918. It takes Congress well over a year to follow through. And I think this speaks again to the sort of persistence of very traditional notions about women's place. And it's also, you know, the South is an important part of that. That particular story. So I just want to say, you know, it seems fast, but nonetheless, there's a long period before the amendment is sent to the states, and then it takes another year for that to happen. It's not so surprising that the amendment and process in the states would take a year, but it does take a long time for Congress to approve. So that's just a little piece about when you were talking about the speed with which things happen that I wanted to underline. As soon as women get the vote in 1920, a whole range of women start organizing to figure out ways in which to use the vote, particularly as lobbyists. This includes African Americans who were particularly interested in anti-lynching legislation. It includes conservative women who have their own agendas, and it includes liberal progressive women who are trying to promote social justice reforms in the 1920s. And so there's a lot of effort to try to figure out what to do with the vote once it's achieved. I'm not sure if that's exactly the question you were asking, Mark. I may have gone off in a different direction.
That's okay. I was basically, what I was getting at is at what point do we start to see the perceptions about women relating to the war begin to influence the suffrage debate, in what ways?
Well, I think Lynn touched on that a while ago when she talked about Woodrow Wilson's speech endorsing women's suffrage. And he is, and I think this is an important turning point, because there were certainly pro-suffrage politicians, you know, sort of pro-suffrage male politicians who, from the very beginning of the war, tap into women's wartime service and loyalty as arguments for their cause. But Wilson had always been a little bit silent or evasive on the suffrage question. He was, you know, aware that there were divisions within his party. You know, his own mind, I think, was conflicted on this issue. He certainly, his views on it evolved, I suppose, is what we might say today. But in that speech, he does actually sort of say that, you know, women's service in the war, you know, means that we should, you know, we should reward them with the vote today. And so I think, you know, that's a, if you're looking for that kind of turning point, that's where I would look.
But I was thinking, do you hear that point echoed in the subsequent, in the debates in Congress or the debates?
Absolutely. Yes. I think in every state legislature, when they're debating ratification, I would be shocked if there was one where wartime service didn't come up. I haven't looked at all of them, and that would take a lifetime, but yeah, I'd be surprised.
If I could actually now bring it back to the point that you were raising just a moment ago, Lynn, which is you were talking about the effects of suffrage upon women's activism. And that really raises an interesting question, I think, that, you know, what difference did suffrage really make to women at the time? You know, was it something that was appreciated as a justified reward for their activism? Why should we care about it a century later?
Chris, do you want to start with this, since I've already talked a little bit about the 20s?
Yeah, no, I think that there was a sense for a lot of people in that the 1920s were going to be different because women could vote. And there were efforts by a lot of the suffrage organization leaders start going into civic work more generally. The League of Women Voters, which of course is still very active today, comes out of the 1920s with the sense that women voters needed to be educated about their new role and learn about candidates and parties, and that the League of Women Voters could provide this as a service to both women voters and men voters. And that certainly is part of it. It is the case that it turns out that women's suffrage didn't change American politics as much as some people expected, both its supporters and its opponents, in part because women generally, you know, don't vote that differently from men. There are different times in American history where you can see a gender gap in the electorate, and we're in a moment like that right now. But that's not always the case, and it turned out in the 1920s it wasn't the case. So it's not like one party really benefited from the expansion of women's suffrage. And in fact, it didn't, you know, sort of fundamentally shake up American politics. But that doesn't mean that it didn't matter for sure.
I would agree with everything that you say, Chris. I think there was a kind of real sadness, however, on the part of women who had hoped that their vote would lead to social justice reforms, because they're up against a very conservative political climate. And there's only one major piece of legislation on the national level, which is the Sheppard-Towner bill, which is a health-related bill that's considerably watered down. And then it's passed, but it doesn't stay in place for more than a few years. So on the one hand, they had the sense that the vote was going to offer these extraordinary opportunities. And yet ultimately, although women are active and they're engaged in parties and they're engaged in lobbying, they don't have a lot to show for it in the era of the 1920s. And so there's a kind of, it's a very disappointing quality among many of the women who had been active in the suffrage movement to see the sort of negative political climate of the 1920s, very conservative era in that regard.
Yeah, and I think that that's connected to the, you know, when we tell the story of the lost generation, in the 1920s, we tell it almost exclusively about men and male authors, people like Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Faulkner. But that sense of loss and disappointment is also, I mean, it's widespread in the sense that this war should have been for something. And when it turned out that less changed than people thought, whether it was in international relations, in the culture, in the League of Nations, in domestic politics, then it led many people to conclude that, well, maybe that war was for nothing or for the wrong reasons. And so a lot of that disillusion is partly about how bad the war had been, but also about how little changed after the war was over.
Mm-hmm. I can't help but think how much more deep that how much more deep that how much deeper that disappointment was for women, because whereas for so many people who had expectations for a new world after World War One, those aspirations, those hopes have been built up over 4 years. For these women who've been spending decades campaigning for the vote, I can only imagine how much greater their anticipation for change must have been by that point.
I think that's true, and I think that the other group that we can point out in that regard is African Americans, men and women, who had expectations about their service during the war making a difference, earning citizenship, had expectations that the Great Migration would make an enormous difference. And the decade starts off with a series of horrible race riots, which really, you know, were a kind of wake-up call for how limited their opportunities would be in the upcoming decade.
Well, that seems to be a good place to end it for now. Chris, Lynn, I want to thank you for taking some time out of your schedules to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.